The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bratvold, Judge Larkin, Judge Kirk. The Honorable Diane B. Bratvold presiding.
Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals, and everyone please be seated. So today's date is May 22nd, 2024. Welcome again to this court. We have a total of five matters on our argument calendar for today, or conference calendar. Three of those will be argued orally, and I see the lawyers are here for the first case. So, Marshall, I will ask you to call the first case, and then I'll have just a couple of remarks before we start.
Calling A230660, Tracy K. Fowler, petitioner, respondent, versus Irwin James Fowler III, appellant.
And counsel is probably familiar with how things proceed in this court, but just to remind everyone, when you do approach the podium and prepare to make your remarks, take whatever time you need to get settled in, and please make any adjustments. The podium does go up and down. The microphone can be moved around. It's just to help make you comfortable as well as hopefully better capture your remarks. We do record today's proceedings. An audio recording is made available on the court's website. And so I'll also remind you, before you start your remarks, please identify yourself as well as the client you represent. There is a clock visible on the podium. Each side is 15 minutes, 5 minutes if you choose a counsel for appellant for rebuttal. And the clock will count down, so you'll know how much time you have remaining. Things tend to go quickly once we start our conversation. So with that, counsel for appellant, we're ready for you.
May it please the court. My name is John Burns, and I represent the appellant, James Fowler. The parties in this case were married for over 31 years. In 2003, wife completed chiropractic school, and she had taken out student loans to finance her studies. In 2016, the parties purchased Spinal Frontier Chiropractic for $25,000. They paid the first half from a marital account, and then in September of 2016, wife's aunt sent a wire transfer for the second half into a business account that had joint funds in it. At trial, wife claimed a non-marital interest in this second payment, yet she didn't call her aunt to testify, nor did she claim that the aunt's transfer was a gift to her and her alone to the exclusion of her husband. After a two-day trial, the court awarded wife this 50% non-marital interest to the business, divided the other assets and debts, and denied husband's request for an award of spousal maintenance. This appeal follows. On appeal, we raise three primary issues: that the district court abused its discretion in awarding wife a 50% non-marital interest in the business. Number two, that the district court abused its discretion in dividing the marital property and debt, primarily the student loan. And number three, that the district court abused its discretion in failing to award husband spousal maintenance. First, with wife's non-marital claim, Minnesota Statute 518.003, Subdivision 3, emphasizes the presumption of marital property and identifies the challenges that a party faces in making a non-marital claim. Specifically, when dealing with a claimed gift, as we have here, the person asking for the non-marital award must prove that it was, quote, a gift made by a third party to one but not the other spouse. And wife never even asserted that position. She testified that her aunt wanted to help her, but she never even claims that the aunt intended to exclude her husband, who at that point that they got the gift had been her husband for 25 years. When the evidence leaves open the possibility that the gift was meant to assist the family as a whole, it is insufficient to rebut the presumption of marital property. Now, wife could have put this entire
Counsel,
matter to rest.
If you don't mind,
I'm sorry.
Last statement that you made where the evidence shows the gift was given to the family as a whole, what's your best authority for that?
The Pulsifer case, P-U-L-S-I-F-E-R. Pulsiver v. Pulsiver. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. It's found in my reply brief on page one.
Thank you.
Thank you. The wife could have put this entire matter to rest if she had called her aunt. You know, we're really talking about a donor's intent here, but she didn't do so. Likewise, her testimony could have gone into greater detail about why she believed that it was to her and her alone, but there's nothing in the record to support that. So for those reasons, we would ask that that issue be reversed and remanded.
So how similar are the facts in the Pulsiver case?
The Pulsiver case involves a situation where a gift is requested, where a gift is claimed to be non-marital. Pulsiver was different in that there was some testimony of other people surrounding it. But like this case, Pulsiver found that the burden had not been met. I think one factor...
I'm curious about the language you use in your reply brief, which is pretty similar to what you argue today. So when the evidence leaves open the possibility that the gift was meant to assist the family unit as a whole, it's insufficient.
Yes.
To rebut the presumption of marital property. Is that a quote from Pulsiver? Because you don't include it as a quote in your brief. So I'm trying to figure out if that's you or if that's this court in a non-precedential opinion.
No, that is the conclusion of that court. I don't know if it's cited, direct quote, but that is absolutely.
Yeah, no, your brief doesn't have quotes. That's why I'm asking.
Yeah,
you. Yeah,
yeah. That is the holding of that court.
And that is a non-precedential case. So at best, it's persuasive authority. So we, to the extent we'd even consider it, it would need to be pretty on point factually.
Yes.
Was it a situation in that case where there was some evidence presented that the gift was intended to help the family?
Just the self-serving testimony of the party. That's the only evidence that existed in Pulsiver. It's the only evidence that we have here.
The person who was opposing a finding that it was a gift testified, oh, that money was intended to help the family.
That is correct.
Did your client provide similar testimony here?
My client provided no testimony on the intent of the aunt.
So then it sounds like Pulsiver really isn't that comparable, especially when we're dealing with a non-precedential case that we.
Well, I would
generally.
No, I think it is precedential. Respectfully, I think that what it goes to.
Well, no, it's a non-precedential case because it's an unpublished case. So.
Right.
Under statute, it's not precedential, and it can be used, if at all, for persuasive reasoning,
right.
But to be used for persuasive purposes, it would need to be pretty on point factually. And if this is the court's decision from that case, and in that case you had the person who was opposing a finding of a gift testifying that that was not the donor's intent,
sure.
That's a significant difference from what we have here.
I don't believe it's a significant difference. And here's why, respectfully. The statute, we've got a marriage of 25 years. At that point, we have a purchase of a chiropractic practice. The first half clearly comes out of marital funds. There's no question of that. And then the second half also comes out of an account where they had marital funds in it. So when you look at those factors, the presumption of marital property and a long-term marriage, I don't think that is overcome by just a party testifying at trial that my aunt intended it to be a gift, and doesn't even go the step farther to say a gift to just me. That's where
your authority for the proposition that a district court could not make a finding that... property was transferred as a gift solely based on the recipient's testimony that the donor, it's a family member, intended it to be for me.
Minnesota,
she wanted me to have it.
Yeah, thank you, Your Honor. Sorry to talk over you there. Minnesota Statute 518.013, Subdivision 3BA, which is where it clearly designates that the testimony has to say that it was a gift from my aunt, in this case, to me, at the exclusion of the other party.
Where in the statute does it say that?
That I gave you the citation right there.
Right, so, but I'm
right.
Curious what language in the statute mm-hmm. says it's not enough for a donor to say it was intended for me, the donor has to testify that it was intended for me and not my spouse.
Right.
Otherwise, there could be no finding that it was non-marital property.
The exact quote this time from the statute, gift made by a third party to one but not the other spouse. It specifically says that it has to be.
It's a presumption that it's marital, and I don't think anyone would disagree that there's a presumption
right.
that gift from the aunt
right.
was marital property. The issue is, to overcome that presumption, what authority says it can't be overcome as a matter of law, which seems to be what you're arguing.
It is.
Based solely on the testimony of the recipient regarding the donor's intent.
Because there's a roadmap in that statute that says, if you want to get out of that presumption, here's what you need to do.
Okay.
And if you're going to say it's a gift, that goes to that 518.013 subdivision 3BA. If that's what you're going to do, you must provide evidence that it was a gift made from a third party to one but not the other. And so that but not the other part of it was never, there's not even an argument that it was accomplished. There's not an argument that.
So what, do you have authority? I'm just trying to follow your argument. I'm not.
I understand.
Trying to be argumentative, but. So you seem to be saying that as a matter of law, the recipient can't testify, well, it was a gift to me, and the district court, in the absence of any other evidence regarding donative intent, can't say, well, I find that testimony credible and I interpret a gift to me, meaning it was to her and no one else.
In my reply brief, I start by saying, I think there's an agreement on the facts. Nobody is disputing the fact that it came from the aunt. What has never happened is any evidence whatsoever from the aunt or even from a wife to say that it was intended to be just to me. It's just after the fact that they are saying, we had this money come in, and
you're saying it can't be proved circumstantially, essentially.
Precisely, yeah.
Do you have any authority for the proposition that the donor's intent cannot be proved circumstantially?
I don't, other than just, you know, the clear language of the statute that I believe directs what the burden has to be in order to meet that. I do think Pulsiver is persuasive. I think it shows how a court worked through some of this previously. There is some confusing argument from wife's counsel in the brief where there's some attempt to do tracing or, you know, show where it came from. As I point out in my brief, that confuses the issue. This isn't a transmutation argument or a tracing argument. We agree it came from Ant, but it never was proven to meet the non-marital threshold. So that, I think it's my reply brief, page 8, really drives home that distinction.
Thank you for answering my questions, by the way, because it was very helpful
thank you.
For me to walk through that
right.
because I understand what your argument is better now. Thank you.
I appreciate that. I've got limited time, so I'd like to focus on the student loan issue as my second priority. Wife testified to student loans that she took out both for her undergraduate degree and her chiropractic degree. And so then what we did is we raised the detail in my appellate brief of the fact that professional degrees in Minnesota have a special type of non-marital property. And page 4 of my reply brief, and relying on the Van Bussen case, V-A-N-B-U-S-S-E-N, as well as Werner, W-A-E-H-R-N-E-R, have established that when you have a professional degree, and that debt to get that should be assigned directly to the party who will have the ongoing benefit from that degree. The chiropractic degree has already generated six figures in annual income every year for the wife. It's appropriate that the debt to get the degree should go with the degree that she will have for her foreseeable future.
And counsel, could I interrupt? I just want to make sure I understand authority for this argument. The case you've cited, Van Bussum, which regards specifically professional degrees, is from the Kentucky Court of Appeals. So again, not binding on this court.
I agree.
And then you cite a Minnesota case from this court saying this same principle is applied to business debt. So apparently we have case law in this context having to do with business debt.
That is correct.
Has this formula that you're proposing we use ever been applied in the context of a professional degree in Minnesota?
I found no authority. Okay. So what I did is I looked for, you know, a similar analysis and brought that to your attention. But I do think business debt, you know, often when we're doing these divorces, the person getting the business gets the business debt as part of the award. I think that's analogous. And so I think that it's...
Let me ask you this, though. You say it's analogous. I'm wondering if it is, because in this case we have findings and testimony that although debt was incurred to obtain a professional degree, only 60% of that debt went to the degree. The other 40% was used to live on for personal reasons. So if you had a business case and you were talking about business debt, I mean, would we consider personal expenses of the family that runs the business to be business debt when we're apportioning it? So is it the same as the facts of this case?
I think that it is. And again, as I read Werner, because I was trying to find some support for this issue, I think that, you know, the idea is you're getting the income-generating asset or ability moving forward. It's appropriate that you should take the debt that was incurred in that case in order to set the business up.
But if we applied that here, wouldn't we say you're getting the business degree and the debt generating, or I'm sorry, profit generating, income generating ability that comes with it?
Right.
Wouldn't it be fair to limit the debt to the amount that was actually used to obtain the degree and not to include debt that was not directly obtained or directly incurred to obtain the degree?
I see my time has expired. If I could try to answer that briefly.
Would you please?
Thank you. I think that's what the court tried to do. I think the court tried to break out that part of it maybe wasn't associated with the degree. It's hard to know. There weren't sufficient findings. But the point I'm making...
The record's pretty clear. The findings are 40% of this went to fund the family's daily needs while mom was in school, unable to work.
Right. When I say the findings weren't clear, respectfully, I'm saying that there's no analysis of the value of the professional degree as it relates to a prospective and moving forward
asset. Was this raised below at trial or either in post-trial motions? In other words, was there a motion for a new trial? Judge, you erred in assigning 60% of the debt. You have to analyze this as a professional degree, and the whole thing goes with her. Was that an argument made below?
Again, I'll respond if that's okay.
Would you please? Thank you.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. And I thought we might get to this point. I'll just respectfully say I think that the trial representation was lacking in a number of regards. I think that there were a lot of things that were not accomplished. But it's still my belief that that this issue and argument is something that should have been analyzed by the court and should therefore prompt a reversal and remand. Respectfully.
Well, let me ask this. I mean, you understand, because you're expecting the question, that we don't decide issues that were not raised below as a general rule.
Yeah.
There is a plain error doctrine. It's a criminal doctrine. It has been applied in civil cases, but under that doctrine, there has to be error which is plain. Mm-hmm. How could we possibly say the district court plainly erred by not applying a legal principle governing property division related to debt associated with a professional degree when, as you've said, we don't have any case law on that in Minnesota? So you're asking us to essentially say we should reverse because the judge sua sponte did not apply a principle that's never been recognized or adopted precisely in Minnesota?
Well, I think it goes a little further than that. I mean, respectfully, the Respondents' Council did not even reply to the assertion that I provided in our appellate's brief on this issue of a value for a professional degree. I think there's
What does that have to do with the issue we're discussing, which is whether that issue is properly before the court in the first place?
I believe, and you can ask Ms. Walter when she testifies, obviously, but I believe that that's a recognition that this is clearly, there is no rebuttal to the idea that the court should have looked at that issue. That's respectfully our position. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for respondent, we're ready for you when you are.
May it please the court, opposing counsel, my name is Tiffany Walter, and I represent the respondent, Dr. Tracy Fowler, in this matter. We talked a little bit about the issue of whether or not Dr. Fowler has a non-marital interest in her business, the spinal chiropractic business. Non-marital property is something that's acquired by a gift or to one spouse but not the other. Dr. Fowler testified that the money was given to her by her aunt as a gift solely to her. She did not go the extra step saying, and not my husband, but there's no case
Counsel,
law.
Counsel, can I ask you, does the record reflect that the wife testified solely to her?
She said to me.
Yeah.
It was a gift to me.
I understand that. And you of course heard the exchange that Judge Larkin had with appellant's counsel. It was consistent with what I was thinking. It sounds to me as though the district court perhaps made some inferences based on the testimony. So I'm not sure if you want to add words to the wife's testimony given the issue here.
Fair enough.
Maybe what you could address is, you know, what opposing counsel is arguing is that in a case such as this, the donor's intent cannot be proved circumstantially. In other words, direct evidence is evidence that proves a fact without any inference. Circumstantial evidence, on the other hand, requires an inference to reach a conclusion. It would seem that your client's testimony was circumstantial evidence of the donor's intent. Are you
Yes.
familiar with any case law prohibiting or
Correct.
Allowing
Yeah.
proof of donor's intent with circumstantial evidence?
Yeah. So, Your Honor, Mr. Burns talked about the Pulsiver case, that's a non-precedential case, but then there's also the Olson case, which is precedential in this matter. In both of those cases, we had testimony by, you know, the donor saying, I intended that gift to be solely to, you know, my relative or you know, whoever it was solely. But in that case, in both of those cases, actually, the evidence that was presented showed that that was not the case, right? In the Pulsiver case, the gifts were made to both spouses, and gift tax returns were done to both spouses. So the court said, I'm looking at, you've testified this way, but in looking at the evidence doesn't support what your testimony is, right? And then in the Olson case, I believe it was a case where there was land, a cabin or something transferred to the wife, or given to the wife, and the uncle testified, I gave it just to my niece. I didn't give it to the husband, just to my niece. But the records of the transaction showed that it was a quitclaim deeded to both of them. And then the Court of Appeals said, no, the circumstantial evidence shows that this was a gift to both of you, not just to one of you. So I don't understand why you couldn't apply the same logic to the situation here where wife testified it was a gift to me. Then we have Exhibit 11, which shows the bank statement from Aunt Sally Kaufman to showing the transfer. The transfer is solely to Tracy Fowler. It is not to Tracy and Irwin Fowler. It is to Tracy Fowler.
Can I interrupt you just for clarification? So what you're telling us is that in Olson v. Olson, the
Yes.
court relied on circumstantial evidence to determine donative intent.
Correct.
Just went in a different direction.
Correct.
With the decision. Okay.
Yes, Your Honor.
To indicate that's...
And in the Pulsiver case as well. They relied on the circumstantial evidence, not on what the testimony was, right? So in this case, we have evidence showing that the transfer was made just to Tracy Fowler. It was transferred to an account that was just in Tracy Fowler's name. It stayed in that account for a couple days, and then it was transferred out to pay. There was no, the balance never went below the amount that was transferred in there. So there is no argument that the money in the account was transferred, you know, became marital just because it was put in a marital account, according to the brief here. So, Your Honors, this gift was shown to be a non-marital asset by all of the factors here, right? All of the testimony and all of the evidence. And again, Mr. Fowler didn't testify any differently. He provided no testimony that this was actually a gift to both of them or anything like that. He didn't even contest it. Appellant is also contesting the trial court's valuation of the spinal chiropractic business. In this situation, the business was purchased in 2016 for $25,000, and the court made a finding that at the time of trial, it was worth $55,000. The court in Johnson has said that the trial court doesn't have to have an exact valuation. Just needs to be a reasonable number picked. The court's findings here were not clearly erroneous. Mr. Fowler made no testimony as to what the value of the business was. Dr. Fowler testified that she had increased the value. She believed she had increased the value of the business, but that there were. It's not a business that has a lot of market to it. Because it's a membership-based business, and this isn't very desirable for chiropractors. So she estimated, you know, a range of figures. The court picked the range of figures, and that's acceptable pursuant to Johnson. The next argument that was made was regarding my client's student loans. Now, again, we talked in depth about how property is presumed to be marital, and that applies to debts, too. Debts are all presumed to be marital. The burden of proof here is on the appellant to show that this should be a non-marital debt. Again, appellant provided no testimony, no arguments to the district court as to why this should be considered non-marital. There is no testimony, no nothing in the record.
Did appellant trial counsel file a post-trial motion?
There was a post-trial motion that was filed. It was untimely, and it was never served on Ms. Fowler or Dr. Fowler's counsel.
There was a post-trial motion and some relief granted, but it was respondent's post-trial motion.
Correct. So we talked, Mr. Burns talked a little bit about the Kentucky case that he cited, as well as the case that applies to the business interests. I don't believe that any of those cases are appropriate for the court to be considering regarding this issue. They don't apply here. There is a precedential case law in the Thrasker case, which was cited originally in appellant's first brief. And in that case, the Court of Appeals decided that that should be a non-marital debt because basically, the decree was obtained, the person never worked in that field, and the court didn't feel that it was appropriate to then assign that debt to the spouse who didn't receive any benefit from it. This case with Dr. Fowler is the exact opposite of what happened in Thrasker. This degree was obtained 19 years ago, 19 years prior to the trial. Dr. Fowler worked for 11 years in the field before the divorce took place. She had that degree benefited that marriage for 11 years before the divorce took place. In addition, there is the non-precedential.
Let me ask you this about the cost of obtaining or the debt associated with the degree. Okay, the district court seems to reason, well, they use 40% of the loan proceeds to support the family, so because mom couldn't work anymore, and mom had been working and supporting the family. So is that really not associated with the degree? In other words, if she didn't have the benefit of that 40% of the loan proceeds going to provide income for her family that she otherwise had been provided and would have provided, doesn't that incur to her benefit in terms of obtaining this degree and the income potential that comes with it?
Mom, I think the facts were that Mom kind of worked for a period of time, and then she went back to school. She worked while she was in school until she couldn't work, and then Mom was a stay-at-home mom after the child was born for a few years. So, yeah, I mean, some of the money went to, I mean, I guess my argument would be that the money went to support the family, right, during that time, not to benefit Mom solely so she could get the decree.
Well, I just mean, does it benefit Mom in the sense that if they didn't have those loan proceeds supporting the family, she may have had to work to support the family, and instead she didn't have to work, she was able to pursue the degree.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess the next question is, did anybody raise this below for the district court's consideration?
No, nobody ran that below. And to be honest, Your Honor, I was not the original trial attorney. You know, I think case law would have supported the court finding that 100% of that degree was marital, right? But Dr. Fowler conceded and only asked for 40% of it to be considered as a marital because she felt that that was the portion that went to support the family during the time that she was in school.
So wife asked for 40%. Was there opposition to her request?
I think that's just, I think it was an assumed opposition, but then there was no opposition. Mr. Fowler testified not at all about this issue of the student loan. There was no testimony whatsoever for him, and there was no post-trial motions on that either. So Mr. Fowler's next argument regarding the judgment and decree was that he should have been awarded spousal maintenance. And he seems to think that the case law in Maurer says that the court needed to find bad faith in order to essentially impute income to him. As the court probably knows, Maurer's not the most recent case law regarding that issue. The most recent case law regarding that issue is the Passolt case, which states that the court does need to take into consideration all of someone's ability to meet their needs independently. And the facts of this case are that Mr. Fowler was the primary support for the parties for many, many years during the marriage. He was a very successful realtor. He had, worked for the Schwann's company. He had owned several businesses, a limo company, all kinds of different businesses, and had ability to make income. Yet, when the divorce happened, he decided he wanted to go work as an aide or something in a mental health hospital for children. And he self-limited his income during that period of time. There was an expert that testified regarding cash flow, showed documentation to the court that Mr. Fowler had the ability to earn money from real estate and to earn money from wages if he chose to do that. So Mr. Fowler in 2021 decided he no longer wanted to have a real estate license and that it was too costly for him, and so therefore he gave up his real estate license in Wisconsin and in Minnesota. But the facts are that Mr. Fowler had a real estate license in both Minnesota and Wisconsin for several years. The parties moved to Minnesota in 2014, and he continued to be a realtor for just shy of 10 years before this divorce took place, and he gave away those licenses, claiming that, it wasn't lucrative for him because he didn't have business contacts and couldn't make sales. Yet he made 6 sales in 2021 before he gave up that real estate license. The trial court's findings regarding the spousal maintenance are not clearly erroneous. The trial court found that there was considerable cash going in and out of Mr. Fowler's accounts, that he had the ability to be self-supporting, and that he was unjustifiably limiting his income and his potential to earn money.
Well, it isn't really the issue that he didn't provide the district court with any evidence justifying why his income needed to be limited, other than this this argument about mileage and all that sort of thing that didn't seem to go anywhere.
Correct. He seemed to say that, you know, that real estate wasn't lucrative for him and that he didn't have, you know, the amount of contacts and he didn't have the ability to sell as much real estate because the parties had moved to Minnesota. But again, they had...
He seemed to say that. He didn't testify. How did he prove that? What evidence did he offer?
He testified that he gave up his license because it wasn't lucrative to him anymore.
Okay, I'm confused because I thought opposing counsel said he didn't testify at all.
I don't think Mr. Burns has gotten into this spousal maintenance issue yet.
Okay, he didn't testify as to the other issue.
Yes,
there understood.
Was, correct. Understood. He did have testimony on this issue of whether or not he needed spousal maintenance, and all the rest of the issues, he didn't testify at all regarding those issues. So he in 2021, when he gave up his license, he had already had more sales than he had the previous year in 2020. So in this situation, the court's findings regarding spousal maintenance are supported by the record. They are supported by the evidence. The one thing is that the trial court relied on the report of Corey O'Connell, and counsel did not cross-examine Mr. O'Connell. So now coming to court today and saying that Mr. O'Connell's report was wrong, that, again, is an argument that wasn't brought up in the trial court. I see my time is out. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel.
Counsel pointed out some arguments on a number of issues that I want to clarify for the court. The first is, again, on this non-marital issue. I would draw the court's attention to page 2 of my reply brief, where I try to lay that out. and what her testimony was and was not. And I think the key that I'm trying to make here is that it's mom's burden, it's wife's burden. If she wants to say that the gift is to me and me alone, that is on her. So beginning in the middle of the page, on page 2, I talk about that, and that she says, respondent's brief argues that wife did not testify that the money was given to us. But critically, she also did not testify that the money was not given to us. And that is an important clarification. I provided the statutory basis to get over the top for the court to have even an ability to say, everything I considered, there has to be that level of evidence to exclude 50% of the value of this business. So I also provide the court with the Schmidt case there as well, another unpublished case, but I think that clarifies that the presumption of marital property was not rebutted. As to the student loans, I draw the court's attention to reply brief again, page 4, where I, again, I was asked the question by Judge Larkin, did he even raise the professional degree issue? And candidly, he did not. And I indicated that. But I also conclude the argument there that by saying the court still has an obligation, that's an asset of the marriage that was never considered or given any value or treated with any review.
Well, and the district court divided it. How can you say it wasn't?
I'm talking about the degree itself. So the degree...
Well, I mean, the district court divided the debt associated with the decree. So how can you... say it was never considered or decided by the district court?
The court specifically dealt with the issue of the student loans. No analysis, no valuation of the professional degree ever occurred. And it is our position that the failure to put a value on a professional degree is the reversible error as it relates to that.
Did your client ask that a separate value be put on the degree? Is that what you're saying? You know, in addition to dividing the debt, the district court should have looked at the degree and said, well, that's a separate asset. We need to value that aside from the debt incurred to obtain the degree?
There is no evidence in the transcript that he either testified to that or that was brought up. That is my position, that the court should absolutely have treated a professional degree as a separate issue entitled to valuation.
Do you have authority for that?
What I provided here is the Kentucky case that we talked about and the Werner case, which deals with business assets.
Got it.
It's our position that those should have been analyzed. Let me spend 1 minute briefly on the maintenance issue that I trust the court will look at as well. I think what's critical here is that, again, they had the only expert that testified on that issue, but that the expert did not put in any expense for my client to work as a realtor for any vehicle expense or travel. On its face, that clearly seems to be in error. Secondly, and there seems to be an admission that there was some pass-through income that was excluded and should not have been, so that there would have been an ability to pay at least.
Again, I have to ask, because what we're being told, again, it's that your client didn't challenge the expert's opinion. Did he cross-examine the expert on these issues and raise these issues in district court?
My client's trial counsel did not cross-examine the expert. My client did himself testify and pointed out issues with the spousal maintenance argument. So to clarify your question from earlier, testimony on that was provided.
Okay, so your client testified, I have expenses, I'm a realtor, I have to drive, there are vehicle expenses.
Right.
And did counsel say to the district court, look, when you're deciding this spousal maintenance, you shouldn't defer to this expert's opinion, you should factor these things in?
And to answer that question, and I see my time has expired, but if I could answer that, I'm a little challenged because the post-trial submissions that were attempted to be brought in were excluded for timeliness and things of that nature. What I can say candidly is there was an effort to try to raise some of those issues, but that effort never made it to the district court's consideration. Thank you.
Any other questions for the panel? Doesn't look like it. Okay, thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
So our thanks to both lawyers in this case. We very much appreciate getting this opportunity to hear from you. The matter is now submitted to the court for a decision. We will issue a written decision within the statutory timeline. So thank you again.